Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
It could be that Hakim Ziyech is under strict orders from Frank Lampard not to waste any energy tracking back when his skills are better utilised trying to create goals for the team. Maybe he was put off when he tripped over himself just as the counter-attack was developing. Whatever the reason, Ziyech's extremely casual approach to chasing down the opposition for Chelsea's third goal did not look great when Graeme Souness highlighted it post-match yesterday. I've looked at the clip a number of times. I greatly enjoy watching this clip because there's so much to admire. The sheer lack of ground that this player covers from the time he took the initial free kick. It's wonderful to see for those of us who remember the days when your skillful wide man wasn't expected to do all the dirty work. I mean, what is he, a left back? He barely makes it back over the halfway line as virtually everyone else in the pitch sprints by him. And I'm not exaggerating here. At the time, okay, so hello guys, welcome to Monday's Second Captain's Football Podcast.
Hello there, Owen.
Owen, how are you?
Please crack on. Don't let us interrupt you, Owen.
I'll crack on here. So Kevin De Bruyne heads the ball into space for Raheem Sterling. That is the start. Brilliant header, by the way, it should be said. But everything Kevin De Bruyne did yesterday was brilliant. But I'm getting sidetracked here already. So that's the start of the counter-attack. At that precise moment, I freeze the picture. And there are 18 players behind Ziyech on the pitch. As in, closer to Man City's goal than to Chelsea's goal. By the time the ball hits the back of the net, 15 of those men have gone past him. And some of them are only jogging, it should be said. It is actually 16 at one point. But a late amble by Ziyech is enough for him to take him back past one of the City centre-halves. So who knows, maybe that will be enough to save him from the wrath of Frank, which was notably absent in Lampard's post-match interview, as Frank this time chose not to throw his own players under the bus. But in the words of Graeme Souness, Ken, big players don't do that. As in, don't just walk back as the rest of the team go sprinting.
Well, all I'm saying is, if you sign Hakim Ziyech, it's not because he's going to bust his lungs chasing back after someone else in the team has lost possession. Especially not when the situation, frankly, looks totally hopeless. I mean, Hakim Ziyech, I thought, was just taken by surprise that Raheem Sterling didn't score the goal. That made it look worse than it really was. Because Ziyech looked around, saw, oh, Sterling is in. Like, who's chasing him? It was Kante. Okay, Kante's good at chasing back, sure. But Sterling is so far ahead of Kante that Kante has no chance of catching him. And if Sterling has anything about him, he is going to score this. And I could start running back now, but that would be very much defensive theatre. Right? Oh, look at me, busting a gut to get back. Oh, my guts are busting it all over the place. I run to get back. But, like, Sterling's going to have the ball in the net by the time I'm, like, halfway into my own half. Oh, wait, what's Sterling doing? Oh, hang on, Sterling. Oh, Sterling. What is Sterling doing? You know, Sterling is now has now doubled back and is kind of pausing indecisively. Well, what should I do with the ball? I'm not really sure. Now, like, half the Chelsea team are actually standing in the goal mouth waiting to see what Sterling's going to do. At this point, Sterling... Okay, and it turns out that Ziyech could have got back now. It turns out at this point that he could have got back. Sterling cracks the ball off the post. De Bruyne scores. I still don't think Ziyech would have made any difference. I thought it was absolutely hilarious that so much energy was expended on Ziyech last night. And I was just thinking, imagine... If Ziyech had been available, how much worse things could have got. How much worse things could have got for Chelsea over this run. But he's actually missed. I mean, I'm just looking at, like, the let me just look at, like, tackles per game in the Premier League, right? There are some players who have literally not registered a tackle. But of the handful, of those who have, there's 400. And of those, where do you think in the 400 Hakim Ziyech comes in terms of number of tackles per 90? Because obviously he's only played 5 times 90 minutes.
He's 384th.
392. Oh. 384th is Billy Sharp of Sheffield United. the only players below Hakim Ziyech are Gary Cahill. Well, of course, being a defender isn't about making tackles. It's about being in the right place. Manuel Lanzini. Okay, not a big tackler. Jamie Vardy. Again, you know, not you don't see him. Jeff Hendrick. I mean, that's a head scratcher. That is a head scratcher. I'm like, how can Jeff Hendrick be there? You know, Carlin Grant, Ryan Fraser, Marcus Rashford, and Nick Pope. And then there's players like Theo Walcott there who literally just haven't done one.
I'm sure it's not for the want to try it on Theo's part. Just the occasion just hasn't presented itself yet.
Look, he's not really a tackler. You know, that's not what he's there for. He's there because he's magic. He's got a magic left foot. You know, he's a chance creator. He's a magician.
Well, so is Kevin De Bruyne, and I saw him busting a gut to get forward to score the goal. But there you go.
I saw Kevin De Bruyne busting a gut against Giovanni Dos Celso, rushing to get back, and wasn't that impressive. To be honest, he would have been better off doing a Ziyech. You know what I mean? He would have been better off doing a Ziyech rather than pounding back with his big red face, you know, trailing vainly behind Giovanni Dos Celso, you know, as though he was going... He didn't end up being taken out by his own goalkeeper. I think that was how that move ended for De Bruyne. Ederson, was that how it ended? But look, you know, everyone has different strengths. What I was particularly impressed by, Owen, also was the squeaks and yelps of disbelief and contempt to which Roy Keane was reduced by Mason Mount.
But look at the first goal there. Sorry, look at it. Look, Mason Mount. He's standing there. He's a midfielder getting back. His centre half's got to do better. Mason Mount's watching him. He's got to put a challenge in. Frank can be scratching his head after the game. He'd be frustrated. I'm looking forward to his interview. But when you got your midfielders coming back, and I know Mount is more of an attacking player, he's got to put his foot. He's got to make a sacrifice. Tackle.
This is what you're talking about, Roy. Let's have a look.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's an all lovely pit from City. Nice and tidy. No tackling anybody. Look, you give players time and space. And Mount's just come into the picture there. I'm looking at him going, you've got to slide in. Just stick your foot in. Look at Mount. He's done after. Look at him. Put your foot in. Tackle somebody. You know, when you're out of possession, football is, you've got to be aggressive.
So that is makes sense. Again, not so much a tackler as he is a presser. Mm. You know, the game's about getting up and getting close to the opposition. Not necessarily getting right on top of them, sliding in, putting your foot through them, or any of those types of things.
That was high pitch, Roy, all right. Normally when the pitch goes that high, there's a tirade to follow. It didn't quite... He just about kept himself in check, I thought.
Well, I liked the way is that as he went on analysing Mount's failure to make a decisive tackle in this clip, the way he began, and he always does this, to become... like himself personally angry with it, even though it's got nothing to do with him, he still, as he watches it, starts to actually lose his temper with what he's seeing, which I just think was amazing.
But, I mean, if they had shown another replay, he would have gone kind of beyond the limits of the human ear. You know, only my dog would have been able to have heard the exhortations on Mason Mount's behalf by Roy Keane if another replay had been shown.
The Sky producers obviously want to pace themselves with Keno in 2021. You don't want him peaking. You don't want him getting to his highest pitch too early. Happy New Year, by the way, to the non-members listening. This is the first time we've chatted to you guys in 2021. We have, of course, been chatting away to our World Service members throughout the holidays, because that's what they've come to expect for their fiver a month plus VAT. A highlight of the Christmas podcast for me was having Ian Ridley on the show to talk about his incredible book, The Breath of Sadness. Ian's a longtime football writer in the UK, as many of you will know, and author of the famous Tony Adams autobiography, Addicted. But this latest book was even more personal. It was all about his late wife, the trailblazing sports journalist Vicky Orvice, who died last year. Ian told us how going to watch county cricket, of all things, played a huge part as he tried to deal with his grief.
County cricket is pretty much the closest you can come to being on your own watching sport. There were times when there were less than 100 people in the ground, so it was peaceful, it was quiet. It certainly gave me a lot of time to reflect on what was going on with me, the rhythms of the game, the cadences, the nuances, in many ways kind of reflected my grief, I found. I would be sitting there sometime having a panic attack, contemplating life without Vicky and thinking, what the heck am I going to do? How am I going to manage? And no one would have known I was having a panic attack, partly because I'm English and don't reveal these things, but also because that was the way I wanted it. I wanted to get on with my grief, my pain, my sadness. If I wanted, I could speak to people. If I didn't want, I could just be on my own. And you've got a ready supply of tea and cake, you know.
Yeah, in fairness, that's important in almost any context, a ready supply of tea and cake. Well put by Ian Ridley there. It's really an extraordinary book, The Breath of Sadness, and it was an extraordinary conversation we had with Ian. Available now on the World Service. Tomorrow, by the way, we're talking rugby in the middle of all these inter-pros. In particular, we look at Connacht, who beat Leinster in Dublin for the first time in the best part of two decades. Right now, I can bring you the first email of 2021.
I've got a call here. It says, you're the most boring, predictable, condescending interviewer around. Go back to lecturing. You have the charisma of a sick bag.
Oh, God.
That's just it. I just mentioned, not you, no, me.
Okay, ain't nobody f***ing with my click, 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 click. Ain't nobody fresher than my mom.
We don't normally click, broadcast all click, the stuff that click, comes from scum click, around the country. Click.
It's from our old friend Rishabh Bajoria. He says, Happy New Year, all. One of my all-time favourite Second Captains episodes has to be 1052, i.e. the famous Ken rant urging some pro-Mourinho Twitter trolls to wake up.
Cheer up. How about you fucking wake up? Wake up!
As was subsequently revealed to us, this uncharacteristic bout of psychopathic rage was triggered by him quitting nicotine. This seems to become a recurring New Year's resolution for our flame-haired flamethrower truth, leading to a spike in hilarity of the football episodes around this time of year. Should we brace ourselves with the same dynamic this year? Which bunch of boring Twitter trolls will bear the brunt of Ken's wrath in 2021? Warmly, Rishabh. Well, Ken?
Well, but the bad news is that I haven't smoked a cigarette since March 13th, 2020.
Wow.
Well done, Ken. Well, bloody done. That is top work. I'm proud of you, Ken.
Excellent. So early lockdown, you just knocked it on the head.
Well, I had a few rollies and stuff that I had to work my way through. I had to work my way through some supplies up till about the end of the beginning of April. So since the beginning of April, I pretty much haven't smoked at all.
That's really, so, really well done. So, I've got no smart comment to make about that.
No, neither do I. I just
congratulations and keep up the good work.
Great work.
I didn't want to make a big deal out of it at the time. You know, there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on in the world at the time. I didn't want to center my own struggle with nicotine addiction. I didn't want to necessarily spend too much time talking about it back in April, 2020. And I don't really want to keep doing it now. All I'm saying is, yes, I've had enough. Don't expect any changes, because you've been living with the new me without knowing it for quite some time already.
All right, today we're chatting to Dion Fanning and Jonathan Wilson after Ken's nicotine-free report on sport.
So, you know, Chelsea fans, I can just imagine them looking at that game, you know, and thinking, look what they've done to him. Look what these players have done to Frank Lampard.
Look how they massacred my boy.
Well, that is what that is. I think what Frank Lampard thinks anyway when he when he reviews the tape. I mean, my boy, I suppose, is himself.
Yeah, so he's Sonny, and he's, the entire Chelsea playing staff are Don Corleone. Is that what we're saying here?
No, the Chelsea fans are... Frank Lampard is Don Corleone, and Frank Lampard is also Sonny Corleone.
Okay.
I mean, it is all about Frank Lampard, as we know. So, his post-match comments, I know Roy Keane said, I'd like to see his interview, because he was saying, I mean, I don't know if Frank Lampard was made aware of the stuff that Roy Keane had been saying, the trash Roy Keane was talking about Mason Mount, but I wouldn't be surprised if we heard a little bit back, because a manager, an embattled manager in that position, has to stand up for his players, doesn't he? I mean, if his players are being ridden roughshod over by the likes of Roy Keane on national television and ridiculed, because Keane was, it wasn't just like this, what's he doing? Like, what's he, like this disbelieving, like yelping and squeaking, his mount doesn't do anything standing near the ball. It was also, I think he's afraid. I think he's always afraid. You know, he started piling more indignity on more insult on Mason Mount. So I think Frank Lampard's got to come out to bat for his boy. You know what I mean? He can't just stand by and watch Roy Keane do this to one of his players. And one of his better players, he would say, you know, one of the players he trusts more, one of the players who's been in the trenches with him since the early days back in 2018, Derby County. So I wouldn't be surprised if we heard, but you know, as in terms of what we heard yesterday, it was much less aggressive. I mean, the Lampard post-match interviews post-match reactions have become, you know, event TV.
Oh yeah,
it's like
Chelsea fan TV brought to you by Frank Lampard, only talking about the players and not the manager.
Yes, you know, exactly. Like the stuff that he was saying after the Arsenal game, just this amazing tirade of, you know, it's not about tactics or systems, it's about basics. Do I want to run? Do I want to help out my teammate? Do I want to sprint, or do I want to jog? Do I want to stand there and think, maybe I don't want to run? You know, and this, and we made that decision. This is the stuff that Lampard actually said last week. Now, I think he must have seen that the reaction to this was a bit, it didn't have the desired reaction. It was directed at the players, and since then they've played twice and got one point against Villa and obviously got completely taken apart by City. And Lampard himself, I think, was widely criticised and ridiculed for this. So his tone this time, after this latest defeat, he didn't do the same thing. This sounded more like he was actually in the boardroom. And he was explaining to he wouldn't be in the boardroom. They'd be in Zoom, I suppose. And Abramovich is on his yacht. And he's saying, why shouldn't I, you know, why shouldn't I get rid of you, Frank? I mean, have you got anything to say for yourself? And he was saying, the expectations are different now, Chelsea, because we spend a lot of money, but the club has to take some pain. So it was like as though he was sort of calmly explaining to Chelsea that this is football. You know, this is how football works. You appoint a manager, you spend a lot of money, you buy a lot of exciting players. The players don't succeed, but you persevere with the manager. You take pain, you go through tough times, and then success. Like it was a formula, like pain plus time. Like, and he kept talking about how this had been the case with Klopp and Guardiola. Like, if you have a Lampard caterpillar plus pain plus time, then you get after a certain amount of pain and time, you get a Klopp or Guardiola butterfly. That's what flaps out of the Lampard caterpillar chrysalis. Like, I just thought this was amazing. Like, how can he be trying to pass this off with a straight face? It's like one of those things where, like add water, you know, like soak the Mr. Potato Head in water, soak the Mr. Potato Head bag in water, and 3 months later it grows into Pep Guardiola. It's just like, no, this doesn't follow. You know what I mean? Like, it's not...
Well, it follows in the mind of somebody as self-assured and as successful in life as Frank Lampard has been up until now. I mean, I presume he actually does believe himself, because he has the self-belief as a manager that he had as a player, even though everybody else has yet to see it from just yet.
But thinking of the self-confidence of this man almost brings tears to my eyes. Like, it's just, it's awe-inspiring. But, you know, he... like, what is actually going on with his team? I mean, he tried something different this time. Obviously, he tried playing Werner. I actually liked the look of the Chelsea team for the first time in a while. I liked the way that he'd set up his front three. The problem was really, you know, that he's done it against Man City, and he's playing against Man City. Man City actually played well. Man City just outclassed his team. And they did it very early, and they did it early so that most of the game was a non-event. It was like, game's over now, so, you know, what do you want to do? It was like the team sort of looking at each other. And in the second half, the answer from Chelsea, Chelsea, remember, were 3-0 down. Weren't they 3-0 down against West Brom at halftime?
Yep.
And brought it back to 3-3. Now, West Brom, obviously, a very different prospect from Man City. This time, they were like, okay, you know, what we want to do is just not really lose very heavily. Because Chelsea had two shots up to the 80th minute, they had two shots, and it's like, that's a team that's not really going for it. You know what I mean? They're not hell for leathering it here. But you know, he'd tried Timo Werner a different position. Now the build up to this game had been sort of interesting because Lampard was talking about how the players needed time to adapt, and he was going on about Kai Havertz having like COVID and suffering with the after effects. But I sort of scratched my head with this a bit, going, why, if Kai Havertz has been struggling with COVID or like the after effects of COVID, have you played him in, well, it's now 8 games since he returned from COVID? Like, that doesn't add up to me. You know what I mean? Either he's struggling with it physically, and he's not physically up to it, or he's not. Like, if he is, then why is he? What's he doing in the team? It seems kind of crazy.
Yeah.
He should be getting rested. So it sounded kind of a bit like, you know, I don't know what the situation is with Havertz, but I just don't understand why you would sort of, on the one hand, say the player was struggling with this long term physical problem, and on the other hand, play him like 8 times.
Yeah, because it's a similar complaint from Steve Bruce about a couple of his Newcastle players.
But they're not playing, though, are they?
Well, no, but some of them are as well. There are one or two who he said, oh, geez, they're just kind of just off the sick bed, you know, like suffering from fatigue.
But I think
Steve Bruce's Newcastle job, you know, a Newcastle team as opposed to Chelsea.
But the two that he mentioned in particular were Jamal Lascelles and Alan Saint-Maximin, I think, were the two players that Bruce mentioned.
There are others. I'd have to check it out.
But there were various others who had COVID in Newcastle. They had a few players, but they were the two I think Bruce mentioned as they've struggled with it, particularly in a long term way, and they have missed quite a lot. Like it hasn't been like Havertz, who I think missed 2 Chelsea games, maybe part of the international break as well. But there's also, you know, the Werner stuff. Like he was saying after the game, they were saying, oh, is there, because a lot of the tone of it was, well, the club's brought in big players, you know, and maybe that creates more pressure on you. That's obviously the theme of this press conference. And Lampard sort of interrupted and said, well, when you say established players, Kai Havertz is young. Timo Werner is young. He's never played in the Premier League. I'm like, Timo Werner's 25, like his next birthday. You know what I mean? He scored 28 goals in the Bundesliga last season. 28 goals in 34 games. Right, and he scored 4 and 17 for Chelsea. Now, is this because he's young and he doesn't know what's going on and the Premier League is so physical and he's never seen anything like this intensity in this Bawa? Is that it? Or is there something else to do with it? I mean, Lampard had a quote before the game about Werner. He said, because in his press conference before the game, it was like, oh, Timo looks to be struggling for confidence. You know, this confidence is like always the go-to explanation of why a striker suddenly doesn't look very effective. And he was saying, well, you know, look, well, it's natural his confidence would go down a bit if he'd missed chances, but his natural attributes will get him in front of goal and away from defenders. And I'm thinking, oh, right, his natural attributes. Because at Leipzig, it was the system that was taking care of that. You know what I mean? Like the system was designed to get him in front of goal and away from defenders. With Chelsea's system, he's been on the left wing. Chelsea says, if you look at what he was doing last season and what he's doing this season, and look at the numbers and what he does in various areas of the field, you see that last season he had one pressure of an opponent in his own defensive third per game on average. So once per game on average, he would press someone in his own defensive third. 7 times in the attacking third. So like it was all concentrated in that third. You know what I mean? That's where he was standing. That's where he was always in that sort of area. And that's where he was expected to expend his energy and his effort, was in that area of the field. Look at it now. And it's three in the defensive third and four in the attacking third. So he's like doing the same amount of work, but he's doing it all along the flank of the pitch. You know what I mean? He's not like, it's not concentrated in areas which are dangerous or which will help him to get into positions he needs to be in to score goals. And then we talk about him lacking confidence, but his natural attributes will take care of it. And you're thinking, well, is there maybe any other reason why this guy looks as, hasn't looked as good for you as he does for his previous team? Anyway, I don't want to necessarily get right into all this Lampard stuff. He said Chilwell is young. I'm like, Chilwell's not that young. Thiago was at the other end of his career. It's like, oh, the porridge is either too cold or too hot. Can Chelsea ever serve up a proper bowl of porridge, which is like not piping hot, but like not so hot that if you stick your finger in it, it gets burned, but like, you know, not cold and sludgy either. Can the club please put a bowl of porridge like that on the table at some point for Frank Lampard? We're going to talk to Jonathan Wilson and Dion about that.
What, porridge?
Frank.
Also butterflies. Lampard,
yeah. Oh, I just thought, yeah, I just thought it might be how they like their porridge, at what temperature, etc. But yeah, so I guess the Man City side of things.
Well, City, you know, City played really well. Again, they had the game won after 35 minutes. And from that point, it was just, okay, we'll play this one out. We've got another game on Wednesday against Man United. And it is an interesting the way their season has sort of developed. A lot of it happening kind of in mid-table, as they've had that game in hand and had a bit of a slow start, and they've sort of been out of the limelight with other teams kind of making the running. And it's probably been the lowest pressure period of Guardiola's time at City in some ways. And yet they're still kind of right there in the title race, just a couple of points off the leading teams. The one issue that they have had is this Mendy stuff.
They're actually only one, like, if they win their game in hand, they're only 1 point behind Liverpool and Man United. But yeah, what's the Mendy stuff?
Well, just Mendy, there was a report about Mendy in the Sun about him having a New Year's Eve party, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah. And it's not like Mendy's obviously not the only player. I mean, there was a couple of Tottenham players, Lamella, Reguilón, Lanzini of West Ham. They were all at the same, or there was pictures of them all at the same party.
Lo Celso was there as well, yeah.
Lo Celso, yeah. But Guardiola was being asked about this Mendy stuff, and his reaction was a bit strange, I thought. He's like, he's a special guy. He has an incredible heart. Like, is this really the way you should talk about this guy, given the situation? I'd like to see how many people judge him if they have the good intentions he has. It would be better if, before we judge others, we judge ourselves. I'm not justifying that. He broke the rules. But don't give too many lessons to others. Of course, it was not correct what he's done. But don't judge him too much. Many people have done the same. It's easy to judge others. If everyone put those intentions aside, maybe it would be better. And you're like, man, like, you're his actual boss. Like, are you happy with this? You know what I mean? You can't be like, given all this, oh, you know, judge not lest ye be judged. I thought you were supposed to be the boss here. Like, I mean, City obviously cancelled their game against Everton. And, you know, is it decided yet what's happened, what's going to happen there? Because this is the players doing the sort of thing Mendy did is a problem for the league. Like, it's a big problem. It's not just a problem as, like, Guardiola did make a point, like, someone said to him, should footballers be held to higher standards as role models? And I think this is an interesting question, because Guardiola's answer to the question, first of all, is, I would not agree with this, like, that footballers should be held to higher standards. The only exception is we do our job. We appear more in social media and interviews, but that's it. I don't think footballers are more important than doctors, architects, or teachers for my kids. So they only have the same responsibilities as everyone else in the world.
But of all of the storms about, you know, sort of off-field behaviour of players, this is actually completely different. Like, this is entirely different. This is nothing to do with being a role model or not. This is actually, if players behave like this, the league is screwed and won't get finished. Like, you know, it's not a role model question. It's an issue of, to do your job, to ensure that your working environment is actually is going to work out, is going to be fit for purpose over the course of the next 5 or 6 months.
And players to allow others to do their jobs. And, not, you know, to allow Everton, who were all set to go, all fired up, ready to destroy Man City, and then they couldn't do it because some City players have COVID. Well, how did they get COVID?
Yeah,
well, was it something like this? Was it something like this? Is this the reason that Everton had to postpone a game and will now have to fit it in against City? Is it because of this? And you can understand then, you know, why there may be some anti-Mendy feeling in some, or why he may emerge as a bit of a villain figure.
Yeah, this isn't Benjamin Mendy going quad biking, you know, and breaking his leg. No. Do you know what I mean? Like, this idea that he fell short of the standards expected of him as a role model in the community. It's like, that is not it at all. Like, that is completely wrong-headed thinking about this particular incident.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it plays out anyway. Obviously, City, as I mentioned, have another game. Now, Arsenal. Arsenal are back, we know. Arsenal are back. And laying down a big marker in the snow was my boy, Kieran Tierney.
Why is Kieran Tierney your... Well, great goal, but why is he your boy?
Great goal, great assist, great cross, Owen. Great cross. A cross so good that Lacazette, who just had to waggle his knee vaguely at the ball, smash it into the roof of the net. That's how good the cross was from my boy, Kieran Tierney. And I describe Kieran Tierney as my boy.
Yeah, Ken, why?
He might be puzzled to hear me say that if he is listening. Because if you recall when he joined Arsenal, I ventured the opinion that Kieran Tierney was better than Andy Robertson.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes, Owen, you could say it was my Karen Carney moment because I ventured this opinion on a podcast where we talk about football and, you know, we were rating signings and so on. And I said in an excited tone voice, Tierney is a really good player. I think Tierney is actually better than Andy Robertson. Yeah. All I've got to say is I'm just glad that the eye of Sauron of the @LFC account didn't highlight what I'd said. Because simply saying it on our world service was enough to get an absolute avalanche of, is it too much to say, hateful?
Sickening,
hateful
abuse. Vile abuse, was it?
Vile abuse from World Service members. Is it too much to describe it as vile? Certainly, let's say, trenchant commentary from people that are saying, how could you say that? You're a moron. You don't deserve to live. That was the general tone of the college.
Did anyone actually feel that you don't deserve to live?
I think they felt it in their heart. I felt that vibe. Like
they didn't verbalize
the text.
Yeah, they didn't verbalize
the text coming through.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know, in many sense, you could say that some World Service members sent me death threats online.
without actually threatening to kill you.
Well, you know, death threats are in the eye of the beholder. So, okay, and, you know, if we leave aside that vile aspect of it, what they were saying was, how can you say this? You know, he hasn't done anything. Like, Robertson is great. And I wasn't saying that Robertson wasn't great. Like, Robertson has been the best left back in the league for a couple of seasons now.
That's not how the deplorables heard it, though, Ken.
Is Robertson now in the... Did Robertson make the FIFA team? I can't remember who was in the FIFA team, but I think he might have made the world team. The point is, Robertson has been a great player and is a brilliant left back. Robertson is playing in a brilliant team with a setup that like suits him ideally, with Sadio Mane ahead of him and a lot of amazing players to combine with, and, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold spraying the ball to him as he tears into space down the left. This is like a dream setup for him to... It's, you know, what I'm saying is his talent is flaring to the maximum possible extent. It's a beautiful thing to see. It's a beautiful thing to see potential being realized in such a loving and caring environment. Tierney's had a little bit of a hard time with it. At Arsenal, it hasn't really been. It's the stony grey soil of Arsenal, and all I'm saying is that this Kieran Tierney seed has taken longer to plant its little roots and to send forth its beautiful green shoots. But what shoots? What shoots? You know, have you ever seen Andy Robertson score a goal like Kieran Tierney scored against West Brom? No, nor will you ever. I don't think, because that's what I was talking about when I made that Karen Carney like comment. When I just said, I just think he's got a little bit of extra individual ability than Robertson, even than Robertson. I don't want to to trample on Andy Robertson here, to tear down the, you know, to tear down the enormous portrait of Andy Robertson overlooking the square, to tear him down and to pull down the statues of Andy Robertson that we've got all over the city. I don't mean to do that. What I'm saying is that I just think Tierney's got even a little bit extra on top of that. And who knows if he ever plays in a team as good as Robertson's been playing for the last couple of years, he, you know, we may even see it in the numbers. But I just got to say, he brought a smile. He brought a smile to my face seeing him do that. And what a tremendous young footballer he is.
Funny you mentioned
this. This is Ked's version of Happy New Year, even to all the haters and losers who messaged me about Andy Robertson and Kieran Tierney.
James Jordan emailed in about Karen Carney. Dear sirs, I listened with interest to the discussion about this, and although there was no explicit moralising or definitive conclusion, Ken's mocking tone of those who argue actually it would be sexist to withhold from drawing attention to her comments because she's a woman suggests that the post was not considered fair game. Fundamentally, I don't see how this is different to second captain's coverage of Jermaine Genas' comments after a number of controversial handballs. A clip of him stating that the Premier League stance on refereeing meant it was the most popular league in the world was played and mocked, with Murph summarising the comments as, "You know why the Premier League is so popular? The handball laws." Genas' argument, which in fairness was played in full, was that the Premier League's focus on entertainment had given it a competitive edge and that the current adherence to the continental application of VAR was affecting it. Whether or not I agree with this argument, at least Leeds didn't misrepresent Carney or misquote her when inviting mockery against an opinion considered ignorant. If I recall correctly, I have only re-listened to the start of the episode, Ken also mentioned Genas' comments to one of the guests later in the show as if to invite further jokes. Is there a distinction between this behaviour and the, as you call it, bookmaker banter employed by Leeds' social media presence? Carney and Genas were both talking as pundits on nationwide broadcasters, so we're speaking on comparable platforms. Genas is a BAME pundit, so is also a more likely target for social media abuse if arguments made by other female journalists, such as those from Susie Rack, have merit. I enjoy listening to your podcast and I would not expect to agree with every opinion, which is normally fair and considered. However, the dismissive attitude towards banter accounts jarred with me, given second captain's willingness to join in on a different occasion at a different target. Kind regards, James Jordan. What did I say? Yeah, it is James Jordan, in brackets, not a Leeds fan. Ken.
James Jordan, not a Leeds. Jay Jordan, not of Leeds. That's what we're hearing. All right, Joe Jordan. Let's. I mean, I can't remember honestly if we misrepresented Jermaine Genas. Do you remember that, Karen?
Well, we played Jermaine the clip Genas. In full, according to James. There,
we played the clip we mischaracterized, mischaracterized in a hypocritical and dishonest way what Jermaine Genas had said. I was at the time when Jermaine Genas sort of drew himself up in his seat on Match of the Day and said, "The Premier League is a product." And then kind of went
from
there.
If it's the clip I'm thinking of, that's the one, yeah.
Maybe it came across more harshly than... was there a snide and bullying tone to our exchange, Ken? Are we guilty? Has he got us here?
Okay, well, what I would say is Jermaine Genas has worked for BT and Matches of the Day for years. He's a really well-established pundit. I mean, pundits are allowed to have terrible opinions from time to time. I don't know.
Well, I guess, I mean, one difference is that, look, we're a kind of a general podcast talking about football and, you know, whatnot. Whereas at LUFC is like the official Twitter account of Leeds, followed by like, like what is it, 666,000 people at last count or whatever. So you could argue that that there's a rather more tightly focused and partisan audience, and also larger, to whom they were sending out this message. And, you know, like, I mean, I think when we were talking about the Karen Carney stuff, I don't think we necessarily agreed that, like, this was a really shameful thing that Leeds had done. I think it's more of a blunder that they made. Like, you know, it's a failure to anticipate maybe what would the consequence be of their thing. I didn't really see it as like terrible in itself, and I do think that it was like some of the other things that they did.
Yeah, you know, and I do think that, like, us discussing an established pundit like Jermaine Genas saying something that we just fundamentally completely disagreed with is a little different to, I mean, we're not on social media here. Like, it's a discussion that we're having about a thing, and if someone wants to take from that to go and attack Jermaine Genas on Twitter about it, I mean, that's still, you know, I think it's a lot harder to make that leap than it is for you to be on Twitter, see Leeds United FC on Twitter slagging off Karen Carney, who is on Twitter, and then going and abusing Karen Carney.
There are at least three more clicks involved in that process, and that is a massive barrier. That's gonna weed out most of the haters. Most haters.
I know it sounds like you're joking there, Ken, but that is actually true in my opinion.
that's the way of the world.
All right. Well, listen, James or Joe Jordan, whoever's tweeting in there, emailing in, I should say, thank you so much for making us think about our own actions. We'll wrap today's report on sport.
It's time to get busy, this motherfucker.
Like we always do about this time.
Okay, all right, I'm going to reveal a piece of information now as well. I haven't smoked a cigarette in 4 days.
So what I'm saying is to this guy, cheer up. How about you wake up? Wake up. Wake up to what's happening in the world.
Pencil. Theon Fanning and Jonathan Wilson are ready to talk for the first, but perhaps not the only time in this year of 2021 about Frank Lampard's travails at Chelsea. Jonathan, in fairness, I probably shouldn't preempt stuff. I mean, we could only go on the one game they've had so far, but that was not great, was it?
No, it was pretty terrible. I mean, all the old problems of not being able to defend counterattacks. They were very lucky to get away with Rodri not scoring ahead of a cross-set play. So those two defensive issues, which have been slightly ameliorated by a change of personnel, by Mendy coming in and Thiago Silva and Chilwell strengthening at the back, the structural issues haven't gone away, even though they've got better players there. But also, and I think this was the more worrying thing yesterday, or as worrying a thing yesterday, was just the complete absence of any kind of attacking plan. I mean, do we have any idea how Lampard thinks those players should set up on the pitch? Do we know what they were trying to do yesterday? And you look at people like Werner and, okay, Havertz, who didn't start. But you look at their form, and, okay, they're coming into a new league, that can be difficult. But Werner's played in four different positions now. Havertz has only started 10 games, he's played in five different roles. So if they look a bit confused and a bit like they don't quite know what they're doing, I'm not sure it's particularly surprising. And you know, you could, I'm guessing from the team he put out, the plan was to attack City wide to get in behind the fullbacks. Well, by doing that, he exposed his own fullbacks and then was unable to put it right.
Dion, what's the main problem that you can see there?
Well, I think looking at the performance yesterday, there isn't anything you could highlight that isn't a problem. I think, you know, people talked about how well Manchester City played, but you know, not just, as Jonathan says, not only was there an absence of an attacking plan, there was no organisation. You couldn't, if you were Manchester City, you couldn't have hoped to face a team as perfect to play against than Chelsea yesterday, because there was no cohesion. The way players were so quickly onto the defence was extraordinary. There's just a lack of a plan in any regard was incredible, and I think it's interesting that and it's very ominous for Frank Lampard, despite people talking about how the players he's bought aren't doing it for him right now. And I think in that very Chelsea way, we might be not far off that sense of these players should be playing for pride. They shouldn't need a manager to tell them what it means to go out and represent Chelsea. But ultimately, when you bring in players and when you spend the money that Frank Lampard has spent, a decision is made by a club like Chelsea, and it's like, do we believe that somebody else can get more out of these players, or do we say, right, Frank, these players aren't working, we'll back you again? And I think we'd know what the answer would be with Chelsea in that regard.
I mean, just to put this in some kind of context of previous Chelsea managers, so Lampard is already the first Chelsea manager of the Abramovich era, with the exception of Mourinho first time round, and he only lasted 6 games, but he's the only manager to survive not winning the title. And since then, he's picked up, so this season, he's picked up 50.98% of the available points. Now, that is worse than every other Chelsea manager under Abramovich in their final seasons, apart from Mourinho the second time round. So it's worse than Di Matteo, it's worse than AVB, it's worse than Scolari, it's worse than everybody, and a lot worse. You know, of those I've listed, Mourinho second time round had 31.25% of points in his second season. AVB is the only other one under 60%, and Lampard is, you know, a touch under 51%. So it's miles off.
Yeah, and this obviously, this also is happening in the context of Chelsea having outspent all the other clubs and bringing in, you know, a lot of good players at a time when other teams haven't really done that. So it sort of looks even worse. And yet I see, you know, Matt Law, for instance, of the Daily Telegraph, a journalist who has soldiered with Frank Lampard, I suppose. The club backed Lampard with their summer spend, and of course he is under pressure, but now is the time for the club to support him. The Premier League season is still very much alive, despite the bad run, and Chelsea are in the last 16 of the Champions League. Big games ahead, hashtag CFC. Should they show faith, Dion?
No, why would they? Why would they show faith? Like, well, this it is, again, we're falling back into that terrible cliche of, you know, the manager needs time. And if Chelsea's manager was Jurgen Klopp, or if it was somebody you could say he did this here, he has a track record of delivering, we know what we're going to get from him, then maybe you could say, despite all the facts that Jonathan has rolled out, you could say, okay, look, let's trust Frank Lampard. We know what we're going to get here. But there's no evidence for that. There's no reason to do that. And, you know, it's funny, I'm watching like Danny Murphy on Match of the Day 2 last night. He's talking about, you know, he needs time. And there used to be, the fallback used to always be when people used to say, to give dud managers time, they'd say, look what Alex Ferguson did. Look what happened. They were going to sack him in 1990. And if it hadn't been for Mark Robbins, Alex, the future of Manchester United, would have been destroyed by impatience. And now that's why we must give every dud manager time. This time, Danny Murphy is saying, look at Mikel Arteta, look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, look what happens when you give them time. That's a very low bar. Now, if that's the bar, fine, give Frank Lampard time. But there is no sense when you look at like everything, and then you look at the performance yesterday, which was and people can point to the players and they can blame certain players, but ultimately a performance like that is the responsibility of the manager, and for that reason I don't think there's any justification for giving him time.
What I find is most amazing about that thing, the comparison with Jurgen Klopp and how Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola,
that's Lampard's own comparison.
It's Lampard saying it himself. It's as though Ruud Gullit or Gianluca Vialli 20 years ago had said, don't sack me, look at Alex Ferguson. You know, I will be the next Ferguson if you only give me another 3 seasons of failure before, you know, I eventually manage to win the cup. Like, the presumption of the man is genuinely jaw-dropping. Like, how does Frank Lampard possibly be deluded enough about his own capabilities as to think that it's a legitimate to compare himself at this point with managers like Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola?
You see, I think what was interesting about that as well is, and I thought listening to Lampard after the match yesterday, it's quite, you know, he's obviously getting a lot of time at Chelsea and he's been given this leeway because of his reputation as a Chelsea player. But listening to him yesterday and that stuff, and also his analysis of the game, I was very struck very much by the fact that this was Frank Lampard speaking on behalf of Frank Lampard, not in the kind of way he has in previous games, where, you know, after the Arsenal game when he blamed the players, but he sounded like a pundit. He sounded like a man delivering an objective analysis of the game. It was quite an interesting analysis of the game. But it was very much clear that this is a person who sees things from his own perspective. And I think when you have had the career that Lampard has had, the way it was built, the way he, you know, developed at Chelsea, the way he was one of the golden generation at England, and I use the term ironically, I think that's natural that you kind of see things entirely from your own point of view. And it was just... he didn't sound to me like a manager who is speaking in terms of what we need to do. It was just an analysis that he would slip effortlessly into delivering that analysis of Chelsea when he ultimately does get sacked and he finds himself back in the Sky Sports or BT Sports studio.
Mm. Jonathan, what do you make of the? I mean, he talks about Klopp, he talks about Guardiola, and he says, you know, these things didn't work immediately. And I suppose that's true in the sense that, like, neither of them sort of won the title in their first season. But in my memory, and my memory appears to be buttressed by the results when I look back at them, both of those managers immediately had a massive positive effect on the teams that they have, that they currently run. It wasn't the case of, 18 months into the run, people were like scratching their heads and going, what exactly is going on here? It was clear from like the first few weeks, this guy is going places.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe you're talking a brave English hero down like this. No, but I mean, I clearly you're completely right. The comparison with Klopp and Guardiola is in some senses ludicrous. And yet at the same time, it's not completely ludicrous in that the expectations of Chelsea, the club, especially having spent €250 million in the summer, 20% of all the Premier League spending in the summer, they do expect to be challenging with Liverpool and Manchester City. And that's the problem for Lampard, because he's not equipped for that. But, you know, it's always this question with, oh, give me time, or managers deserve time. And I think football clubs, by and large, are almost invariably too hasty. I think it's a very easy option for clubs to sacrifice the manager. Something needs to be done. Sacking the manager is something. It's a cheaper something than getting rid of half a squad. It's an easier something than working on a gradual incremental process of development. So therefore we'll do it. And that's how football runs. But at the same time, after 18 months, you should be able to see some kind of development. And you talk about Guardiola in his first season. I mean, did they not win the first 10 games of the season or something that season, City? Certainly they were playing.
They started with something like that, 9 or 10 games, and including beating Manchester United away in a really big game.
And they were playing a style of football that made you think, Christ, I've never seen anything like this in England before. Klopp was obviously starting from a lower base. The squad was nowhere near as good as Guardiola's when he came in. But I remember that first game away at Tottenham, and there was just a sense of excitement. Even the first 20 minutes or so of that game, and they tore into Tottenham. You thought, OK, that's what this guy's about. Even Ferguson, the comparison back in the 80s, if people talk about it now as if United were completely hopeless in the late 80s leading up to that Nottingham Forest Cup game. But they finished second in the league. And everybody knew the problems at United. They knew there was a drink culture at the club. They knew that there'd been huge problems going back, I mean, really since Busby retired for the first time in 1969, but it never quite been sorted out. Lampard wasn't coming into Chelsea. Lampard was taking over a team and finished third and had got to the Europa League final. Yeah, there was not some kind of terrible poison that needed to be sort of slowly worked out of the system.
Well, that's gone in the memory hole as well. Like the fact that Chelsea actually were a decent team before Frank Lampard took over. Like he's sort of made it seem as though it was a big salvage shop. But what amazes me about him, right, is that for all this talk about time, and he doesn't actually just talk about like Guardiola and Klopp. He was talking about guys like Kevin De Bruyne. You know, and I felt as though he was trying to make a kind of a parallel there as well. Like, you don't want to write people off too early. This club has seen too much of that over the years. Kevin De Bruyne, Mo Salah. And it was clear it's all about time. Like, he was some kind of a craftsman. And I was like, hang on a second. For a guy who's so keen to be given time, you were not keen on taking your time to get to this point in the game. Like, he just ran straight for this job. He snatched it at the first opportunity after one season in management with Derby. And now he's there. He's at a job which appears to be beyond him. And is there maybe a lesson? I mean, you're saying, Jonathan, there that clubs are too quick to sack managers. But have managers like Lampard been too quick to rush into these jobs? But like, you know, maybe there was for a long time this idea, you need to serve your time, you need to learn your trade, you know. And maybe they've seen too many people like manage lower league clubs and then just be forgotten about. It's like 10 years later, no one remembers these people. So, and then, you know, maybe someone like Guardiola, who comes in at a big club and makes an immediate impact, that's the sort of model someone like Lampard wants to emulate. But maybe a better model for him to emulate would be his old rival Steven Gerrard. maybe the slow and steady method adopted by Gerrard has proven to be the wiser course between these two guys.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of slightly apart from the Lampard discussion, but I think it is a huge problem in modern football that, and you see it time and again, that a manager will get a club promoted out of the Championship into the Premier League, and then they're scraping around to get to 35 points, and their reputation is inevitably damaged, and eventually they do get relegated. And then what happens to them? You're seeing, Eddie Howe isn't even being talked about now in terms of jobs, because his reputation is stained by the inevitable eventually toppling him at Bournemouth. So I can completely understand why aspiring managers, and particularly high profile ones, are reluctant to serve their time. I don't think serving your time is as straightforward as it used to be, just because the gulf between the top and the bottom is so huge. I was about to say, to be fair to Lampard, I certainly don't want to do that. If I were Lampard and I were desperately clinging on to my job and were desperate to save my position now, pointing out Chelsea's haste in the past and saying, what you don't want is me coming back in 5 years as manager of Manchester City with two Champions Leagues on my belt, that's not the daftest thing to say. To stay the finger on the trigger.
Yeah, I don't know what else Lampard is going to say in those situations. I think, is he going to say, well, yeah, you're right, I'm completely out of my depth, sack me now? Like, I think, I think there's things to be made between Lampard saying he needs time and the commentary that says he needs time. And I think it's understandable if he tries to push things out a bit, but when people look at it from objectively or from the outside, they have to look at it and go, well, on what basis do we give them time? And then that's the problem. And I think the Gerrard thing as well, it may right now seem like a more prudent course, but I think it may be also, I suspect that when Gerrard does finally take the leap from that job to the big job, you will probably see the same issues with the sort of Steven Gerrard brand taking, working in parallel to whatever club he's managing.
But at least it'll strung it out over a few extra seasons.
Well, good is you're just postponing the inevitable.
Well, we see how a very different brand of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is working. It's magic, Jonathan, at Manchester United. You have had your doubts about Solskjaer at United. Do you finally have those finally been cast to one side given their recent resurgence?
No, not at all.
But they're amazing.
They have some very good players, and they're adequately put together. I mean, there's still rumblings from inside the dressing room. There's still
rumblings.
Players
there are rumblings.
There are rumblings. No.
What kind of things are we talking about here? You can run a few blind items.
Certain players feel that the training is pretty basic. They feel that the attacking planning is not as sophisticated and coherent as it might be. I mean, United basically are very good at sitting deep and hitting teams on the break. And if Bruno Fernandes plays well, they win games. But when they actually have to take the game to the opponent, and the opponent sort of is well organised and gets a couple of breaks, then they're pretty limited. And this is always a problem with any assessment in modern football, that even in the Premier League, which is among the big five leagues in Europe, is by far the most open, still the season, okay, this season's a little bit different, but still seasons are determined by 8 games, 10 games. It's about not dropping points against the smaller teams, and then you're actually tested in, against the other members of the big six. But Arsenal aren't doing that well at the minute. So, big five. This season is a bit different, and you do have the likes of Leicester and Wolves and Leeds, and Everton, who are posing problems for teams. But you saw Solskjaer's limitations in the Champions League when, in a group with Leipzig and PSG, he was outthought, despite getting against, two great results to start with.
But that's against, they were against, teams with top players and clever coaches. that's not like most of the teams in the Premier League.
Yeah, you know, but if you're Manchester United, do you want to compete with Leeds, or do you want to compete with?
Well, if I'm Man United, winning the league would be a superb outcome.
but it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Well, you know, do you share this bullish and perhaps brittle confidence, Jonathan's expressing?
So just
here.
Just speaking about brittleness, sorry, just a minor observation that Miguel made the other day. Lampard has started speaking much quicker in his post-match interviews than he used to. Like, honestly, listen to the pace of it. It's like he's speeded up by about 20%.
Why do you think that might be happening?
Anxiety. He knows he's under pressure.
Really? Okay. Well, Solskjaer is. I mean, there's a difference between him and Lampard, which is that Solskjaer at least doesn't seem to think it's all about him. You know, I mean, he's almost too much the other way, Solskjaer. He's kind of standing in front of the cameras, and you can almost see the cogs in his brain turning as he thinks, what would Sir Alex Ferguson say? You know what I mean? Like, he's expressing, he's not thinking his own thoughts. You know, he's trying to think Sir Alex Ferguson's thoughts and trying to say the things that Ferguson would say. But, you know, they had a gut-wrenching defeat earlier this season, Dion, when they lost 6-1 to Tottenham, and he had Jose Mourinho parading around, strutting around nearby, and it must have been pretty hard to take. And all Solskjaer said was, this is my fault. You know, I'm sorry. this is all my fault. You know, I promise I'll try not to do this again. And, like, you know, at the end of it, like, a little bit of humility, it turns out, goes quite a long way, because this team, notwithstanding the fact they lost to PSG and Leipzig, if you look at the rest of their results, you know, since November, they've won nearly every match.
Yeah, I think the reason Solskjaer does what he does and falls and talks about the Manchester United way is because it is actually slightly self-centered, in the sense that he is there because he represents the Manchester United way. So it is quite important for him to always stress that in him you see the essence of Manchester United, and it is humble. What was it? You know, Ed Woodward had a sort of definition for that: humble and proud to wear the club blazer, but then arrogant when it stepped out onto the pitch. So that is what Solskjaer is stressing. But I think ultimately you're still in the same position with Solskjaer that we've always been in, where it's like there are times when it can look seductive and it can look that he may actually be the Manchester United, the manager that Manchester United want and need. But ultimately, it's people trying to wish that into existence, even at this stage. And I think the other thing about this season is, because we've gone through Christmas, people are kind of thinking, all right, now Manchester United have gone through the tricky Christmas period and here they are challenging at the top of the table. But in fact, because of the season, we're actually, it's more like, you're kind of in mid-December. You know, it's not early in the season, but it's still pretty early in the season. And there are a lot of decisive games to come. And you look at the top of the table and who's up there. It does strike me that, we are still, especially because of the way this season has been, in that early stage where people are trying to, are jostling and challenging. And it reminds me, there was a line about the leaders of the first round leaders in the Masters, and it was, I think, the golfer Peter Jacobson said, the slums of Chicago are full of first round leaders of the US Masters. And I think it's a bit the same in the league this season.
There is one interesting pattern to their results this season, which I wonder whether you can make any sense of this one, Jonathan, which is that previously, under Solskjaer, Manchester United tended to be pretty good in big games and then struggled to sort of beat medium or smaller teams because of their, it seemed as though they were struggling to create chances in these types of games. Now, that's changed around this season, because if you look at their results, they lost 6-1 to Tottenham. They obviously did beat Paris in the away game of the Champions League and lost at home. But they lost. Okay, so look at their league results. They couldn't beat Chelsea at home, nil all. They lost at home to Arsenal. They couldn't beat Man City. That was another nil all.
They've beaten basically everyone else. You know what I mean? The big Champions League games, also PSG and Leipzig recently, they lost those ones. Leicester is another game, the only other game in the last couple of months that they haven't actually won, and they're the only other sort of higher ranked team. So why is it that they suddenly are finding it difficult to beat the rival teams and are wiping everyone else?
Well, I think they're good records. I mean, I think it comes back to the same thing. They're good when they can counter. And also, because they have good players, and I think Cavani's added a huge amount to their attack. Yeah, against a weaker side, if it's deep against them, the chances are they'll still win because they're just good. They're better players. And, you know, Cavani's alertness and smartness around the box, I think, is really exaggerated that. So, previously, big teams were maybe slightly naive against them. They attacked them. And you think of the three games when United beat City last season, and that was certainly the case. And this season, City went, we're not going to come out. We're going to sit in. What's going to happen? And it turns out when you do that, nothing happens. And it was exactly the same in the Chelsea game. So, you know, if you look at United's home form, okay, it's picked up a bit recently, but I'm sure the reason that their home form was so much worse than their away form the first sort of 2.5 months of the season was obviously home and away is very different now to how it often is, but still, there's a sense that the home team the onus is on them to take the game to the opponent. So, away teams quite happy to sit off, and what happened was stalemate, or United overcommitted as they did against, say, Palace. But they were in danger doing really against West Brom. It was only that very odd penalty being overturned that got them back, that stopped them going behind that game against West Brom. So, I think a decent team who defends well against them, who doesn't overcommit against them, it's very hard for United to create chances against them.
Well, you said the word penalty there. this has become an issue over the weekend, or it's become a narrative. It's become a conversation. I could see Richard Keys and Andy Gray standing here gravely next to a list of Manchester United penalty statistics. Manchester United on penalties. Penalties awarded 33. Penalties awarded against 7. This is since the beginning of the 2018-19 season. Keys and Gray think there's something here to talk about. I think in the same time period, Dion, Liverpool have 17, Manchester City have 18 penalties. Is there a conspiracy afoot? is there a conspiracy? Okay, you laugh. Maybe that's leads me to suggest you don't think this is a conspiracy. But why do you think this might be happening?
I think one of the reasons I think United are have got exciting attacking players who draw fouls out of players and are draw fouls out of defenders, and
more exciting than Raheem Sterling or Mohamed Salah.
Well, again, it's a very small. It is quite a small sample size. Overall, it does look like things are favouring Manchester United, but I think last year, people were talking about VAR, Liverpool, and that kind of stuff. So there was a sense that it was favouring Liverpool last season. So I don't really think. I did think there was it Shaw against Villa? Was there a moment during that game when? Was it Shaw who I think Pogba was
Shaw went down and Pogba was like, seemed to express frustration and make a gesture indicating, go down next time.
So like there might be something, they may feel that the gods are with them in this regard, but I don't think there's any, I would be, I'm open to all conspiracy theories.
Well, I wonder, right, with VAR, if refereeing is becoming increasingly political and actually increasingly vulnerable to this type of narrativizing or influenced by narrative. Because, say, for instance, you mentioned last season's Liverpool narrative. Now, if we take an example from a game involving this said Liverpool, earlier this season, Man City against Liverpool at City, City got a penalty when De Bruyne whacked across at Joe Gomez, who was sort of running in front of him, tried to get his hand out of the way, but it hit his arm. Now, it was like, come on, that's not really a penalty. VAR had to decide whether to give the penalty. Okay, it's sort of a, it's the ball's clearly struck his arm, but it's, you know, it's not really a penalty. However, the VAR knows that last season, in another game between Man City and Liverpool at Anfield this time, there was another penalty decision with another Liverpool player having a handball. The ball, remember, hit Trent Alexander-Arnold's hand. For some reason, it wasn't a penalty, even though this was much more of a penalty than the Gomez one. Play went on. Fabinho scored. They decided to let the goal stand. Liverpool won the game 3-1 and ended up cantering to the title. That was a massive decision in their favour at a key moment, which materially affected the title race. And there's no way, with that having happened last season, that the VAR cannot give this penalty against Joe Gomez now. Do you see what I mean? What I'm saying is that I think because you now have the opportunity to weigh these factors, whereas before you had like half a second to decide, will I blow the whistle or not? You now have the time to actually weigh these factors, that actually the past is influencing the present when penalty decisions happen. It is like, well, we can't be seen to give Liverpool too many easy decisions this season. And that what's happened before is actually affecting things. That part of Liverpool's struggle this season, or their perceived struggle against the officials, has to do with last season's Liverpool, when all the decisions seem to go in their favour.
So basically, what you're saying is that this, you know, it'll all even itself out once the
I don't know if it does even itself out, but definitely the fact that Keyes and Gray are standing there in Qatar solemnly looking at this table of Manchester United penalties and demanding an explanation is not good news for Manchester United, because all the VAR guys are going, oh well, you know, we don't want to be seen to be adding to this disgrace. I honestly think that is going to become a problem. That is more of a problem now that you have VAR and they have time to kind of take these things into account when deciding whether to give a penalty. Because they are taking... There's no way they're giving penalties or they're not taking these kinds of things into account. How can they not?
Yeah, no, I think that is a problem with VAR. All right, the sense that... everything, you know, I think referees were probably always susceptible to that, but as you say, because you know they were making decisions in real time, they may instinctively make a decision that they think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that,
but or the decision that the crowd is going to cheer in the stadium, which, you know, at least they're happy.
Yeah, whereas that doesn't, you know, I think one of the great examples of a referee refereeing the game as he felt it should be refereed, rather than what was happening, was Howard Webb in the World Cup final in 2010. But I think the VAR obviously does accelerate that, because you do have them looking at it and filtering in some way, looking at what they're seeing on the screen, but also filtering through various thought processes and narratives, as any human being probably would in those situations, or try, you know, and trying to separate your decision from those narratives is tricky. So maybe it will. It will be tricky for Manchester United to keep getting those kind of decisions as the season goes on.
Yeah, Jonathan, your last quick word on Ken's theory there.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has always existed. I mean, you know, the other, it's, you know, it's not just recent history and what sort of the conversation in the media is about. It's also that if a decision goes against a big team, the furore is that much greater than if it goes against a smaller team. So, you know, for instance, that penalty that West Brom had overturned at Old Trafford, if that had been the other way around, I'm sure we'd have heard way more about it. But it's just, well, it's West Brom. Yeah, we move on. Yeah, as to the United penalty against Villa, I just don't think that's a penalty. You know, I think... We've and this is a VAR problem, I think, that we've now got ourselves in a mindset where any contact in the box somehow legitimises the player going down. Once a player goes down, a decision has to be made. But the question of what caused the contact, which for me there was two players running next to each other, and there's a little sort of brush of the thigh which knocks one of Pogba's feet onto the back of his right heel, knocks his sort of left shin onto his right heel. And then he goes down. Now, I'm not saying it's a dive necessarily, but I also just don't think it's a foul. There's been no sort of extension of a leg from a Villa player. There's been no sort of lunge across him. There's been no, not even a leaning on him. And you know, leaning is okay, I think. And, yeah, and if you can lean with your shoulder, I think you can probably lean with your hip and your thigh. So, yeah, I but you know, this is the problem with any use of technology in football. That these things are subjective, and when you see it in real time, you have some sort of gut feel as to whether that degree of contact was acceptable or not. Whereas when you slow it all down, you say, "Oh yeah, there is a touch there. Well, that probably is what caused them to go down. Oh, we'll give a penalty." I think in that situation, you could equally well have given the free kick the other way because two players' thighs have touched each other.
Jonathan, Dion, good to see you both on your game for 2021. Thanks a million.
Cheers. Thanks, thank you.
Southampton versus Liverpool tonight in Monday Night Football, or the Monday Night Football, the Sky Sports presenters have noticed recently. Has anyone noticed this? Have you guys seen this?
TMNF.
The Monday Night Football. It always strikes me as a bit clunky rather than just Monday Night Football, but there's obviously a reason. It's the pro.
I mean, Monday Night Football is, you know, I mean, they've obviously stolen this idea from the NFL, and it's known as Monday Night Football, isn't it? I don't know. You've opened a real can of worms in my brain here.
Well, anyway, it's Southampton against Liverpool, so it's a good game. Before we go, though, Ken, we'll talk about that and that happens in that one on the World Service tomorrow, as well as chatting about the rugby, which is pretty interesting at the moment. But before we go, you did want to mention the boys in green over in the Premier League and how they are faring at the moment.
Well, I don't know when the thought struck me, but I think it was on some stage on Sunday, it was on Saturday. I think it was after. Probably, I started to think about it when I saw poor old John Egan lying face down after like 3 minutes of the Palace Sheffield United game. He's lying face down because Schlupp has put Palace 2-0 up, and Palace obviously went on to beat Sheffield United. And I was thinking, just as the game started, the Brighton against Wolves game, like, how cursed are the Ireland players? Like, how bad has this season been for everybody, almost everybody involved with Ireland?
Hang on, did I not see Aaron Connolly score an absolute worldie?
Well, not a worldie, but a goal,
you know.
Aaron Connolly at that point hadn't done that. Aaron Connolly hadn't done that. And I was... I was thinking, okay, right. Stephen Kenny, 8 games, 1 goal, no wins. You know, internal power struggle against like someone who, you know, dark forces, people who don't have the interests of the team at heart or whatever, you know, whatever's going on with that. It hasn't been a dream start, right? Darren Randolph, he's been basically.
Got a game, though.
He did finally get a game, but. You know, he's been, I suppose Kelleher has had a good, Kelleher's been the star, you know, Kevin Kelleher, although he's also our other kind of bench goalkeeper.
It's turn of blood for Matt Doherty. Well, though he did get sent off.
He got sent off. Like his career has been in free fall.
I just remembered that.
Ever since Stephen Kenny made him the number one right back, he's been
Hold on a second. He actually has played a couple of games in the last couple of weeks. There was an uptick and then he got sent off.
It just hasn't gone great so far, the move.
Jamie Coleman flying high for everything.
Is he flying high? Well, I mean, he's missed quite a lot of the season, injured.
Yeah, but I mean, still, his team is going well and he's still club captain and he plays when he's not injured.
But he hasn't really been able to take advantage of this situation because he has been injured for a lot of things. Shane Duffy, who I saw playing for Celtic, like he came on for Celtic as they lost to Rangers 1-0. Just you know, you're kind of watching through your fingers going, what? This is terrible. Like, oh my God. John Egan, I mentioned, and Enda Stevens are the backbone of this record-breaking Sheffield United disaster. Worst ever start in the Premier League. James McCarthy sort of not really.
Well, that's going there. I want to know all about that.
Yeah. What do you think? Has anyone noticed that James McCarthy hasn't been around much?
Well, no. Of the two, James Max in midfield, there's no doubt James McArthur is the preferred option.
Yeah,
you know?
he's the dominant James Mac.
Yeah. Jeff Hendrick is 380.
Glamour move to Mike Ashley FC and
395th out of 400 tacklers 400 in the Premier League. That's not great. That is a poor statistic. I'm not going to lie to you.
You know, Robinson, he got those two goals obviously against Chelsea, but otherwise it's been quite bad for us. Ida, you know, Ida, no goals since the opening day. Smashed his knee, you know, but he's out for a long time. Parrott had to start the season with a bad injury. No goals in 11 now for Millwall. You know, Malumbi doesn't even get on the Brighton bench a lot of the time. Although that's started to change since they increased the number of people you could put on the bench. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it hasn't been. And Connolly, and I was thinking Connolly, you know, one goal so far this season, kind of has been pushed out of the team. They signed Danny Welbeck to sort of compete for his place. And I was thinking, you know, okay, Robbie Brady's done okay. You know, by his own sort of standards recently, injury hit, he's had an okay season, but still, like, if you told him in 4 years ago, this is what your season's going to look like, and he probably would have been like, oh, really? And just as I was thinking, what's going on? Aaron Connolly scored that goal alone. Aaron Connolly scored that goal.
And then nearly scored an unbelievable bicycle kick about 10 minutes later.
Unbelievable. And I thought to myself, maybe that was the darkest hour. Maybe that was the you know, maybe now the stretch starts to come in the evenings for these Ireland players. Maybe things are going to change. Maybe 2021, it's all going to change. One thing's for sure, Owen, it can't get much worse.
Well, except he went off injured at halftime. But yes, that was. I'll leave that thought there.
Okay. To be honest,
his work was done. You know,
Owen, I actually didn't know that. I didn't know.
Ken's work was also done at that stage. Representing that, yeah. That's grand. That's Aaron Connolly back on the horse. dear. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Kira.
Thanks everyone for listening. Happy New Year to members and non-members alike. We'll talk to a good chunk of you tomorrow and through the week, and the rest of you next Monday. Take care. Bye-bye.
Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.